So, it is my great pleasure, mostly because he's talking, not me, to introduce John Gibbett, who is going to tell us about mathematical issues associated with the regularity question for Navier-Stokes.
Okay, thank you. Well, what's happened after Greg's talk last week, Shreeley had a cough fab and decided it was a good idea if we had more pedagogical talks, and I volunteered Charlie, and Charlie volunteered me, and there was this sort of brief struggle between us, and he claimed that being aware and not having his slides and made God pleased about this, that somehow it landed on me. And so, I mean, I'm afraid I have to apologise for adding to yet more of the burden of the number of talks that you have to listen to today, so I'll try and not make this too painful. Now let's begin with a little bit of history, and I've used this story before, but those who've heard it will forgive me, I'm sure. But Euler was born in 1710, I think, and died in 1783. So he spanned three quarters of the 18th century, and his collected works are about 100 volumes. I don't pretend to have read even tiny percentage of them, but an Irish friend of mine has read a certain proportion of these, and he says that somewhere in these 100 volumes, Euler expressed extreme disappointment that some of the time, about 10 years after having written down what we know as the Euler equations, he expressed disappointment that they hadn't been solved completely. So this would have been sailing about 1750, so one quarter of a millennium later, one sort of feels that we, despite what we know more about the Euler equations, we feel that we've gone backwards and not forwards. And if Euler was here today, he'd probably say that we have gone backwards and not forwards. And the Navier-Stokes equations have been with us, say, for just a little under 150 years. And there was a big issue with the Navier-Stokes equations as to why, as to the regularity, meaning can we show that there are no singularities in 3D Navier-Stokes. And indeed, I would point you to the fact that Peter Constantine who pointed out to us about three weeks ago. He said that if you look on the IMS web page, Felix Bravo of Rutgers, who's the current president, is running a conference in Arizona on mathematical problems or issues. It's UCLA, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. For the 21st century, and he identifies three problems which he claims are the problems of the century: the Poincaré conjecture, the Riemann conjecture, and the regularity problem for Navier-Stokes. But the three things that he has actually identified. So what I want to do is really give you some overview of why it is we've failed so far, and what the issues are about why it is that it goes wrong and we have yet to prove regularity. So this is really a story of failure, not a story of success. Okay, but let us sort of make a beginning. And just ignore that I brought up here, this is to just save me time through the talk. Let's sort of go back to one of the great men of the last century, and let's go back to Landau and Lipschitz. I think it's fluid mechanics, chapter 9, something like that. Now what does Landau do? In his own wonderful way, he sort of encapsulates things very nicely. He says, take a box of Sidwell, and dimension D. Okay, D being 2 or 3. So the volume of the box is like L to the D. And so if, for instance, this was a 3D cube, you would have something like this. And then he said, think of a fluid, turbulent fluid in that box. And he said, well, I'll take some little vortex, which is like the smallest vortex there is. Indeed, I may not, you know, we may not be able to resolve it. But he said, imagine that you can resolve it at some length scale, little L. Okay, so the volume of the vortex would be little L to the D, like so. Therefore, he says, I think this is what's so wonderful about Landau and Lipschitz's books, that they have this sort of just general ideas that are sort of running up. Therefore, he says, let the number of degrees of freedom, which I'll define as curly, you would say the number of degrees of freedom in the system, therefore, goes like the number of vertices we can fit in the box, which would be capital L to the D of a little L to the D. Like so. Okay, now of course this is a very nice idea, but it's sort of loosely defined in the sense that how would we get some grip on what little L is or capital K L is when we actually look at quantities in the Navier-Stokes equations. The task is to show that there was a lower bound on little L or an upper bound on capital N. What I want to do in this talk is to sort of try and show you through the Navier-Stokes equations how you can identify either this object or that object and find bounds on it. And we'll have B equals 3 over here, and we'll put B equals 2 over here. Okay, the sheep and the goats. Alright, a good biblical analogy. Okay, and I want to sort of show you why things work in 2D but don't work in 3D as far as our understanding goes. Okay, and we'll try and make some identification about this idea of number of degrees of freedom and little L, because that's really the task. Okay, so. Now, let me also tell you something that we know. First of all, that I've written down the standard Navier-Stokes equations with some forcing function divergence free. Now, the reason we do this is essentially, this is the most basic stripped down problem that we have. What we're going to do is take some time independent, so the fluid is like stressed by this forcing function, and you can put whatever bounds on this if you like. If you wanted to make it temperature, okay, and a function of time, then of course you need a passive scalar equation to couple in with it, but that essentially confuses the basic issue. So we're going to take the periodic domain of dimension D, and for convenience we'll have the center of mass in a zero frame, so basically your velocity field are mean zero functions, and you can do that without lots of generality. Okay, so all this will become clear later. So let me now, something like 95% of what I'm going to tell you is what you know already. It'll just be a different 95% for each one of you. Okay. Okay, so let's do something. Let's actually see where the problem lies. If we now take this in vorticity form, then let's write this as d omega by dt is omega dot grad u plus nu Laplacian omega plus curl f. And over here, because we have no omega dot grad u, so we have Laplacian omega plus curl f. And this total d is this total derivative here. Okay. So, of course, we always say, the sort of thing we learned at our lab is really, we say, oh, well, of course, 3D turbulence is caused by vortex stretching, etc., etc. But exactly how does that occur? Well, let's do something similar. Let's take omega as the scalar of the vector omega, and we can rule out this as V IDT is alpha omega, scalar omega, plus nu omega hat, and I'll just do that because the full thing we're not interested in at the moment, and this alpha is exactly, well, we can of course write this as the strain matrix S omega, so I can write that as omega dot omega, and that we call the stretching rate. Okay, now this illustrates a neat point, that the time derivative of the scalar vorticity, now here with alpha, this if you use Rayleigh's quotient, of course basically alpha is not exactly an eigenvalue of S, but it must lie within the spectrum of S, because Rayleigh's quotient says it must, because S is symmetric. Okay, so if we think of the eigenvectors of S sort of moving around like this, and the vorticity vector moving around like that, and this is at every point in the fluid, then of course when omega gets close to aligning with an eigenvector of S, then alpha would become an eigenvalue. Okay, and you can, now of course if we imagine that alpha is a constant somewhere, of course it's not a constant, then alpha positive gives me exponential stretching and alpha negative gives me exponential compression. And anybody who was at my talk last week would recognize that this alpha would be the gamma that I have for the Burgers vortex, and that stretching and dissipation actually balance, and something like this for alpha constant would give me exactly the vortex tubes. But the reality is, of course, that alpha is a non-linear function r of omega mu, and of course, therefore, it is of course possible that because of that, there may be possibly an algebraic singularity in omega, possibly. Now, this is sort of just general. We want to quantify this sort of idea. But it's violent possible as omega moves around and it aligns through eigenvectors and then away from eigenvectors of S, this is the cause of these huge vorticity gradients. And that vorticity compression that you can actually see is probably the cause of these sort of tongues, these sort of fractal tongues that one actually sees in the vorticity field. Now we want to be able to quantify how fast omega grows. And in 2D, of course, it's relatively easy, and in 3D, it's difficult. So what I want to do is to take you through what we can do and where it goes right and where it goes wrong. So, let's forget that for the moment. Let's now look at these objects. I'm going to take this as the standard global energy. Over my periodic domain, this will be my global entropy. Now, this is an important point that many people don't realize. This grad is a sort of shorthand notation. It's really dUi by dxj. And n derivatives is like, it is like n derivatives, all n derivatives of every component of U.
So this is Emerald's tensor.
Yes, it's a tensor object. It's just shorthand notation. So this is really sigma over r and j of dUi by dxj square integral r. Okay, now it's not difficult to actually show that on a periodic domain is actually, for a general vector field, is actually that.
So you don't need
isotropy,
you just need periodicity.
Yes. Now, that is generally true for on a periodic domain. And of course, when they're incompatible and dU is not, of course, you've lost that, and it's equal to the integral of omega squared. But of course, if you want to make life more real than this, and you have boundaries, and you want to make the fluid incompatible and not incompressible, then immediately you have problems. Because for compressible flow, you couldn't flow that away, and this would not be exactly equal to that.
If I have boundary, if I still have incompressible and I have boundary where I have no slip condition, it's still be true.
No. No, because you've done an integration by parts to get to this.
If you don't have any shear at the boundaries, as long as the if you have a box,
static boundary does not slip, will be
true. Okay. Yeah. Right. But if there's any shear.
So on this very simple stripped down problem, life won't go relatively easily for you. Okay. So let me do something that you already know. Everybody's familiar with this calculation. Let's look at the time derivative of the energy. Okay? And that, of course, is u dot Laplacian mu minus u dot grad u minus grad t plus f uv. Okay, now we all know how to do this. Now let's integrate u dot grad u, of course, that vanishes on a periodic domain because w is zero, so we can get rid of that. U dot grad p also vanishes when u is divergence free, so we can get rid of that. And of course we can integrate that part on this one. And so that gives me, of course, exactly this object here, which is by famous energy dissipation rate. Here, plus that object. Okay. Now we can do two things. By of course, that is what experimentalists can measure. Now, we can do two things with this. We can break that up, and we can use Cauchy's inequality, so I can put a there, and I can put H naught to the half using this norm notation where P is 2. Okay. Now, you can draw two conclusions from this. The first conclusion, and everybody knows this, but I just want to mention it. The first conclusion is this, that you can now use what I call the worst inequality in the universe. It's called Poincaré's inequality. And Poincaré's inequality, well, unfortunately we have to use it because there is nothing else we can actually use. Poincaré's inequality basically says that this is less than its gradient of a periodic mean zero domain, and then you need to compensate by an L over 2 pi by your domain.
D to the square root.
Squared, yes. Okay, now the problem is that's a terrible inequality, it's awful. You lose huge amounts of information in it, but you don't have anything else to actually use. But that said, that in effect H naught to within a constant is less than H1. By this definition. And so I can actually replace this and say that a half H naught dot is less than mu L over 2 pi over L squared H naught plus H naught to the half 2. Okay. Now, this introduces a concept that some people have seen before and some have. I've got minus h naught to the 1, I have plus h naught to the half. That tells me that if I make initial data on h naught sufficiently large, this term will win, and basically its time derivative will be negative, and so it will start to contract. And so with some radius, some value of h naught, where these two terms balance, that if I'm outside that radius, I come in, and if I'm inside that radius, I will stay inside it. And so what we'll actually have, if you want me to write the thing down, what people do in this business, if you look in Constantine Forash's book and the sort of history of the literature, they invent something called G, which is like the Grothendieck number, which is defined in this way, and if you actually want me to write it down, you can actually say that H naught in some time, large time limit, over all initial conditions, we won't go into the technicalities, it's for 3D, it's bounded by something like L mu squared G squared. Now that's a terrible bound, but all we're interested in is that the energy is bounded, it's a finite object. Okay? And in 2D there's an equivalent result. But the second thing...
Can you make a theorem that there is a steady state and it is stable?
No, it's not the steady state, but it's what we call an absorbing ball. Now think about 2 as a phase space, but it's infinite dimensional. Okay, this is the way you think of it. And with this sort of ball in L2, basically if you start outside, anywhere outside, you're pulled into it. Because you're starting initial data basically where this term is bigger. No, you can't go out. But if you try to go out,
as soon as you hit the surface,
it's an inequality. So this thing, so basically, once you're outside, you're pulled inside. If you're inside, you stay inside. So it's called an absorbing ball. And this, of course, is true. There's no dimension in here. So this is true for these two and for these three. The energy is bounded. Now, the thing is, an absorbing ball in L2 is not very good. There's not much information because we know if something's L2 bounded, all sorts of horrible singularities can occur spatially and temporally. You need more. And this is not enough to define an attractor and a global attractor. You need more than that. Okay? And but let's do our second piece of information, and this is again something everybody knows, that since we know H naught is bounded, I can time average, this bracket is not a statistical average, it's a time average, we can time average across here, and then we can say that this object is bounded above. So we generally have the energy dissipation rate at the tau average is something that really is bounded. Okay, well, we know that. Okay, and this is what people measure experimentally, but of course, because it's tau average, it's exactly from this that we define the Kolmogorov length. Okay, so we would define the Kolmogorov length to be exactly this over mu cubed to 1/4, and we know that object is bounded above.
That would be epsilon times L to the D.
L to the minus D
right.
To compensate for the volume in where. Okay. So what you have in here is that the energy is a bounded object. We have this absorbing ball, and it's true on both sides. It's true on both sides. 2D and 3D. But we need more. L2 boundedness is not enough. And this is where things go wrong for D is 3 and go right for D equals 2. So I'm now going to take you through quickly the calculation in D is 3 and D is 2 to show you why it goes right here and wrong there. And when I say wrong, it's not that the calculation's wrong, it's that our methods fail, essentially. Okay, so. And if you want to come up with Greg's talk last week, essentially, this time average of H1 establishes Lorentz weak solutions that go back to 1954, that H1 may not necessarily be bounded, it may have potentially singularities in time. But this time average, this time integral is bounded. And so any of these singularities, these weak solutions, are not the time integrable. And this is what sort of basically Lorentz started this whole industry of weak solutions nearly 3/4 of a century ago, and it's basically essentially based upon this line and these calculations here. Okay, so let us actually have a look now at what we would like to do. And so we need, here we have this absorbing ball. That's, okay. To be a proper global attractor, not only do we need H0 bounded, but we need the global entropy bounded. Now everybody said, well of course that's true in 2D. Okay, well it's obviously true. Why is it that we failed to prove this in 3D? Well let me show you why. Let's take a half H1 dot. And this of course now will give me, this is d omega by dt, and so what am I going to have? I'm going to have mu Laplacian omega minus omega dot grad, sorry, plus omega dot grad u minus u dot grad omega plus curl f. So that's integrating. We'll call this term integrates away because it's u dot grad omega. We'll ignore the forcing. This term integrates exactly to minus nu, and it will be given grad omega, and grad omega is two of these tensor derivatives on u is one on vorticity. And so this is minus nu h2. So that's that term. And now we have to estimate this term. And this equals. Okay, so, plus the force. I'll just do that for the force. Okay. Now, this is where we need to do something with this term. Now, what I want to do is to basically break it up where by the Schwarz inequality. So that would give me the integral of omega to the fourth, the half, the integral to the half. And for Charlie's sake, we'll do that. Okay, this is a quarter H1, and so this equals H1 to the half, and this, using that normal notation up there, is alpha squared, using that normal notation. And this is what we're forced into doing something. You see, everything here, all the nasty stuff is the vertex stretching term. It just doesn't exist over on this side amongst the sheep. Now what we have to do is estimate this thing with our four. And this is what we're forced into doing, what's called a sub-level inequality. Whether you like it or not, we're forced into it. And so the sub-level inequality that you use, but there's an infinite number of routes you can pick. But the sub-level inequality that we use is basically going to be this one. And so if I want to estimate a function in L4, I can come down to the function in L2, but I need to then have some control over its gradient in L2. And I have, when I balance the numbers, and this is just dimensional analysis. You see, there's a volume integral in here, one in there, one in there. You need 3/4 of here, and you need 1/4 there. Just dimensional analysis. Okay, now that's true for all mean zero periodic functions.
Just push your comment. Yeah. The theorem is not dimensional analysis, but remembering the theorem is dimensional
analysis. Yes, that's right. Thank you, very good.
There's a constant out front, and that constant you want
to see.
The constant is finite.
And there's a constant, what you're right, there's a constant.
But otherwise it's true that the constant might be infinite.
Okay, so let's put that in here. Now what does that give us? It gives us this half H1 dot.
And mention also, that is only true in 3D. In 2D,
yes, yes.
4D, those numbers are different.
Well, numbers are different if you're in 2D, because this is a dimensional balance on volume, and the volume is all cubed here. Okay? So now what is this? This would give me, with the square, this would give me, that's my constant, H2 to the 3/4, and then I have an H1 to the 1/4, and then I have a half here, so I have an H1 to the 3/4 as well. And now we see, now this is just giving me a moment, so this is worth doing. How do we do something with this? Well, I have a mu there, so I put a mu in here, and I compensate for that. I take the C out, I put the C in there, for the 1/4. Now that, you see, mu here, minus 3/4 plus 3/4 compensates, and I've done it this way because I have 3/4 and 1/4, and I can now use a Hodel inequality, which says a to the 3/4, as long as it adds up to 1, a to the 3/4, b to the 1/4 is less than, okay, 3/4 a plus 1/4 b. And so now you see I've done it, so this balances out with this, and so that's less than plus 3/4 mu H2 plus 1/4, and then that absorbs into that C mu to the minus 3H1 cubed. And that's basically a Hodel inequality. Okay, now you see I have minus 1 here and plus 3/4 there. So that's H2, absorb the 4 into the C, H1 cubed, and if Charlie wants the forcing, we'll do that. Okay, and we're almost there. So, one more line. So I have H1 cubed, and I have H2. Now, do I need to write this down to convince you that if I take H1 squared, let's just do it here. Omega squared is omega dot ku. I can take the curl across in an integration by parts in a divergence free field. I can actually take that over and write that as curl omega dot u. Now work that up, and this is squared, squared, squared. Work that up by Cauchy. This of course is H2, and this of course gives me H0. So H1 squared is less than H2 H0. And that of course then says that minus H2 is less than H1 squared over H0. Now let's do this in orange. Squared plus C mu to the minus 3 H1 cubed. And now you see where the problem lies. H0 is bounded above, so minus 1 over H0 is also bounded above. I have a minus H1 squared playing up against an H1 cubed. It's too big. The exponent is simply too big. And if I start large initial data on H1, I will never basically get this term to beat out that one. I can only win with the negative term. I want H1 to come down, so I want the negative to win over the positive. I will basically never do it unless I start with small initial data on H1. And that was Lavoisier-Sky's result from 1960. She was the first one to show that Navier-Stokes is regular for small initial data. And you can see it exactly here. Start with very small initial data, but it's much smaller than this. Or,
what about large viscosity?
Large viscosity is the second thing, so basically root of a minus 3, large viscosity. So flow of a trickle barrel is regular, which we all basically believe. Okay, so small initial data is okay, large viscosity, but if I want small mu and arbitrarily large H1 for initial data, I'm lost. So what we're saying is that not that Navier-Stokes, 3D Navier-Stokes is not regular, we just fail by this method. Now, let me challenge you with the following thing. If you said to me, but I'm smarter than you, and since you're doing inequalities, there's an infinite number of ways you can break this up. Why don't we just do it a different way? Okay, why don't we just do it a different way? Okay, and so, okay, well, I'm going to say that I can get something like this. You're always going to get this term, because this is Laplacian. But say I got something like mu to the alpha, H0 to the beta, H1 to the gamma, and you think you're smart enough that you can do better than me here. Okay, and then you have to get some term like that. Can I do dimensional analysis like we teach? When I teach calculus to first year physicists, I always get them to do dimensional analysis on every line. Now, what is H1 that? H1 is 10 to the minus 2 L cubed, and then I have a derivative. So each term is L cubed 10 to the minus 3. This must also, therefore, be L cubed 10 to the minus 3. Now, mu, of course, is L squared over time. H0 has its whatever dimension it has. H1 has whatever dimension it has. Fix it and see what you can get for alpha, beta, gamma. And see which is the optimal thing that you can get. And you'll discover that you cannot, basically, the best choice that you have, in other words, the smallest value of gamma you can get, is that alpha is indeed minus 3, beta is naught, and gamma is 3. That is the best you can do by dimension. So in other words, by this method, you will not beat this 3. You are already optimal. Okay. So in other words, it isn't as if it wasn't smart enough, you simply will not beat this 3 by this method. So you need some other method other than this. Okay. Now I would remark here at this point, briefly, that if one actually looks at all the calculations that so many people do, when I was at Newton, everybody who was respectable had one of these computations, one of them was another, and I had a cube, and then I had lots of colored vortex tubes. But when you actually look at those computations, you see that the ladder only fills about 20% of the volume. The higher ladder fills maybe less than 20% of the volume. And there's all this amazing spatial structure with all these worms around. And of course, simply by taking an outer average, we're actually watching over all that spatial structure. We're losing all that very, very delicate spatial information that's actually around the flow. So I would say that actually taking norms like this is bad news. You're basically integrating, averaging over all that spatial structure, which is where all the delicate points of turbulence actually lie. And in some sense, it's actually showing up that this is too crude a measure, I believe. Okay, but we don't know, have any other method of doing it. Okay, well, let me say that about that, it was Lavojanskaya in 1960 who did small initial data. Now, yes, of course, if you want to raise Laplacian to a higher power, to the gamma, then of course you can simply raise that as high as you like, and then you win. Okay. Now the other.
Right, there's a five gap there. It's not critical. 1.25 if it's Laplacian to the 1.25.
Yeah. 1.25
is enough. Laplacian to 5/4 is enough.
Okay, at this point, maybe comment how accurate is actually the Del squared known for Navier-Stokes? I mean, are there any empirical measures
on that? Oh, you're into the world of kinetic theory, which I don't think I'm competent to comment on.
You mean that particular form?
How good is what, you mean? As a representative.
It's so accurate based on low Reynolds number stuff. But the next term that comes in kinetic theory is the Burnett coefficients with Laplacian squared. And sort of by symmetry, it has to be that, by isotropy and symmetry. It comes in with the wrong sign. So it has to go to the next one.
Yeah.
But then you have two more dimensional material parameters, and all of your turbulent results would depend upon these two other material parameters. Which no one yet is claiming that turbulence is really different in different fluids, the ratio of their parameters.
Are there any better information about the integral kernel? I mean, if it turns into an integral kernel, what's that?
You don't gain it. You're playing this game in an integral form instead of a differential form. Mm-hmm. But it's the same game. You can't beat it out that way.
Now let me make one more comment before I move over to the 2D. The game that people have played for 40 years, it's instead of doing this, and I don't want to get caught up in me, since this is lap grad U, people have played this game of saying, okay, well this is lap bell squared, 2 to the A, and then instead of going down to another L2, you come down to U in, say, some LQ. Okay, and then the game they play is, assume that object is bounded by assumption. Okay? Now this O therefore will be dependent on this Q. And if you play this game, you can actually get this experiment well enough, okay, to get regularity, in other words, if one is bounded. But that's based upon the assumption that with U and LQ is a bounded object. Now, with how low can you get Q?
Yeah.
Okay, now the answer is, in Lavojanskaya, that Q had to be greater than or equal to 4 around 1960. And then Sarin, I think in 63, got Q greater than or equal to 3. And then Fourashes got greater than 3. And Fourashes actually showed it could be 3 relatively recently. But it's a game. You see, you're assuming that is a bound, assuming it is bounded. Now, of course, we know it's bounded when Q is 2, but having Q is 3 is just, we can come down to Q is 3, we can't quite get down there. Okay, and that's where the problem lies. And that's
Q of velocity integrated
for
volume
is finite.
It's finite. That's
all singular. Well, it probably is, certainly. Yes, now the problem is, let's just go back to the calculation on the energy. This, of course, was for L2, which was Q is 2. And of course, the pressure integrates away. But as soon as I made this integral of U cubed, the pressure does not integrate away. And any estimate you have on L power LP for Q higher than LQ for Q higher than 2 will always bring the pressure field in. And so we come down to Q 3, here's Q 2, and we can come down to Q, we can't quite close that gap. And that's where the problem lies. Now I agree with you morally, experimentally, I'm sure we believe that there really is a bounded object, but in terms of the analysis, there is this sort of hole, this gap. that we can't climb. It's like having a curtain which is like 3 meters long, the window 3 meters long, and the curtain is like 2 meters and 99 centimeters, and we just, wherever you move it, there's always this 1 centimeter gap. And we should build it, the curtain, there's always a hole.
But I guess because of the problems that
we'll
do with the pressure
curve. Yes.
It's a kind of some local integral.
Yes, exactly.
Now, were you going to mention the pressure result?
I want to go over to 2D now, because now, having shown you... Now, this is sort of like a story of failure. This is my own way of demonstrating what goes wrong with the problem. Now, of course, all of this has come from that, but finally come from the vertex stretching term, which is not there in 2D. And so in 2D, we're in great shape, and we can immediately say that the H1 dot, immediately we simply have that term, that term, that term, and we track it through, and it's simply this one. Minus mu, H1 squared, H0, plus your forcing. Okay, and with no vertex stretching term, there's no H1 cubed, and we're in great shape. We have automatically a bound on H1, there's not a problem. Okay, but therefore, this ball, in technical language, and the analysts say, basically, it's not just bounded in H0, it's bounded in H1, it's basically compact in L2. And that is enough. So this is compact. And this is enough to define what's called a global attractor. Now, there's a lot of technical things we don't need to know about. But if you look in Konstantin and Frosch's sort of work, they did this great paper on communications in, it's the current journal, Pure Planet Mass 85. And they defined all these this sort of object. And so what we have this global attractor that attracts all the dynamics wherever you are. If you're outside this ball, you're pulled into it. If you're inside it, you stay in it. And moreover, you've got enough control over the derivatives to actually really define this object, this global attractor, which we'll call A. Carry away. So the question is now, let's get back to Landau's question. Now I've got information, how can I turn the information I have here on this object to this and sort of make any identification?
But that's also true, the Euler equations are well defined in 2D. So
yes, but if you actually look at the definition of what you need for global attraction, you don't have an absorbing ball.
But what I'm saying is, yeah, Euler equations are regular in 2D,
yes,
so you don't have to even talk about global attraction.
Yes.
Regular initial debt.
But
there is no global attractor in the sense of here, because global attractors, I rather not go into the definitions, but you need basically dissipation. The equations have to be parabolic, and which of course Euler is not. So there is a definite distinction.
Oh, I see. The other thing is, because of this inequality for H1, you could actually start with arbitrarily high, formally infinite H1. You could start with lousy initial data here and immediately come in with anticipation.
Now, the point about this global attractor is this. How do we make an identification between this object and Landau's idea? Well, the idea essentially is this, that this thing has a dimension. And the uppermost dimension which you can compute. Okay, well, we know what
Lyapunov
is
a number of positive exponents.
Yes, and I will show you quickly, because we're short of time. Now, what do we do? What do we normally do for Lyapunov exponents for finite dimensional dynamical system? This is for finite one. The Kaplan-Work formula, which goes back, 20 years or something like that, essentially says this. That if I have my attractor, that if I take some exponents defined in a particular way, which we call mu, Okay. The Kepler work formula itself this. The tip now moves by the following. The tip that the sum is positive. So if the sum up to n, capital N minus 1 is positive, then I choose 1 more n, such that it then becomes negative. So I have 1 more n. I think everybody knows this. This is probably 95% of what people know. Okay, you add 1 more n, basically, so the new n, capital N, is basically negative. Then less n, but that particular N, so you have to keep on adding them up. Well, this is an experimental thing that you did, but finally you found this value of N that turns the sign of the sum. Then that N, that's the dual, and I have a formula for this dual, and it basically goes like this, N minus 1 plus the sum, it's actually like this, it's actually minus the sum of these new N's to capital N, over, sorry, I'm not doing very well here. This is n minus that over mu n, and you can show that this dl is bounded above bar n, below bar n minus 1. So this arm is an experimental object we have to find by keep on adding on more and more experiments in the sum until we find the one that turns the sign of the sum. And of course that arm then bounds above the flat enough dimension of the attractor. Now that's for finite dimensional dynamical systems, and it's been around with us for a long time. Now what Constantin and Forash did, 85, is that they showed that the whole procedure can be lifted over rigorously to the idea of a global attractor, where you're not in a finite dimensional space, but in an infinite dimensional one. And I haven't got the time to do all the rigor for you, you just have to take my word for it. But what they showed, essentially, is that you can identify what these Lyapunov experiments are based upon 2D Navier Stokes. And what you do is, of course, that you take d by dt of some small variation of omega, is mu, some small variation of omega, and then, of course, what you're going to have is the minus u dot grad, small variation, minus delta u dot grad, omega, like so. And this you write as like A delta omega, and this A is this operator. Okay? Then the muons are defined, the sum of the muons are defined to be, and this is the way they work, the time average of the trace of this operator A projected onto a set of orthonormal functions by I, and those orthonormal functions basically span the attractor. You're in a Hilbert space, everything is nice and regular, there's not a problem, so these orthonormal functions exist, and you can project onto these orthonormal functions, everything is sort of nicely defined, and that is the sum of your global Lyapunov exponents, and they do it. Now what you need to do is to work out that time average and find that value then that turns the sign of that sum, exactly like here. Okay. Now, what I argue, what they argue, what we argue, is that you can then morally identify this dual or this n with this number of degrees of freedom of the system. With the dimension of the global attractor, you basically identify with the number of degrees of freedom of the system. And the result that they got was this. It's coming. What they got? Now, if you want to do it in terms of this G, if you want, they got G to the 2/3 n plus log G to the 3rd. If if you don't want to do it in terms of the G, and you go to the penultimate line of the calculation instead of the last line, you discover that everything comes out in terms of the time average of H2. And you say, ah, well, that's extremely convenient, because H2 is not other than the n-strip dissipation rate. Okay? Mean times the n-strip dissipation rate defines the correction length for 2D. And when you translate this into the correction length, you find exactly the correction length squared, which is the right answer, and then there is a 1 plus log L of E to K as a correction.
Third still, right?
No, because the third has come off. Okay. 2/3, 1/3, squared, 1. Okay? And of course, what did Landau say? He said the number of degrees of freedom goes like L over L to the B, the dimension of the system. Now, this is 2D Navier Stokes, D is 2. And we found that the L is this correction length. And so what actually this calculation does, it actually rigorously takes you from all smooth initial data, it recovers the correction length exactly as dimension analysis does. It actually gives you the correct exponents, exactly. With a logarithm. But that had to work very, very hard. Now this was done by Constant Forash and Tehran in 88 in Physica B.
The algorithm is just, you have some of the estimates you have to do, you have to do, you just have to log. Yes, you have to log the beta, and you don't want to just log the beta, although we found very simple ways to reproduce this result, but haven't been able to find even a complicated way that reduces. Chuck, I mean, the original calculation, I know the code, it's Constant Forash and Tehran, Chandler did write a code that was basically doing it a simpler way, but it was really just a simpler route through the difficulties that we're actually doing. So what this algorithm does...
Is it K related to the column of origin to the K or length?
No, this is the correction length.
I don't know what this is.
Oh, I think so, it's the correction length.
It's
Excuse me, this is the correction rate, the unstructured dissipation rate, defined to the 1/6. So it gives the right answer in the sense that it should give the right. And if the estimates were bad, you would not have got this 2. And if you go to the history of these estimates, this sort of number, it started in the 60s as e to the g. If we want the first estimates, then they came down to g cubed, then they came back to g squared, then they got g to the 1, and then finally, in this 88 paper, they got this g to the 2/3, and then realized that they basically hit bottom, because essentially you've got, this is equivalent to the power of 2, which is the right answer, with a log correction. Okay, so in a sense, if you make this identification of the Lyapunov dimension of the global attractor of Landau's number of degrees of freedom, it looks as if you sort of hit the right identification. The problem is, as I've said in 3D, we don't even have an attractor. We have no proof, because although we've had an absorbing ball, it's not compact. You can't do this calculation. It just won't work. Okay. So that will work, finally. How much time do I have?
4 minutes.
Okay, well, briefly. Very briefly. What do we have? What can we say? And this is really just a quick list. And then Norman can ask me 3D questions.
You said, well, okay, attractor finite dimensional. Can you actually identify what are these modes? Can you write normal variables for the finite dimensional system?
No, you can't, because it doesn't say, it doesn't do it in terms of modes. It does it in terms of exponents.
Right, but I mean, very fun kind of
No. 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 No, it's a totally different.
Yeah.
And we don't know what the structure is.
Some work by James Herman collaborates that you do exactly trying to identify so by a dimensional manifold.
Yeah.
No, that's different.
Oh, that's a different thing.
For a inertial manifold, that's inertial manifold business. For 2D Navier-Stokes, there is a finite dimensional attractor, but no one knows if there's an inertial manifold there.
Okay. If somebody wants to read how you do this...
manifold, and there isn't one established.
Yeah. Somebody wants to read how you do this. In the book that Charlie and I wrote, essentially the calculation is chapter 9. In our book on Navier-Stokes, we take the sort of read us through it line by line as to how to make this identification, and then actually how to find this and do the estimate and find the end. Okay, now briefly, for these three, what can we say? We don't have the strong, what we call strong solutions. We don't have any bound on the global entropy. But what can we say? Well, first of all, the ray told us that this is a bounded quantity. But of course, H1 may blow up, it may have singularities, but its time average does not. Two, can we exploit that in any way? Well, the answer is you can. And this, I just like to make this descriptive. We can get a sort of higher inequality than this for HNs. And there's an M here, and there's an M there, and then there's an M minus 1, and then you've got other nonlinear terms. And what you can define is define this object, which I'll call HN over HR, so that's N derivatives over R derivatives, where R is less than N, so the 1 over 2 into N minus R. Now if you look at the dimension of this object, the dimension of these kappas is L to the minus 1. So it's a wave number, it's like a wave number, but of course they're functions of time. And you actually find that if you fix R and then string out these kappas, they're actually working on inequality, like kappa, so 1 naught is less than kappa 2 naught is less than kappa 3, and they sort of string out nicely. What you can prove is that the time average of these kappas is bounded. Okay. Well, the time average of these kappas is bounded above, but the bound is so rough that you can get it in terms of a Kolmogorov length. If you want me to write it down, it goes like this. And it looks fine. L over lambda k, well, that's the Kolmogorov length until I write in that it's a fourth power. Now, for instance, if you have a meter cubed of fluid and lambda k in the atmosphere is about 1 millimeter, it says that the bound is about 10 to the 12, which tells me that my small scale is somewhere around submolecular scale, maybe in subatomic or nuclear or something like that.
Strictly less than infinity.
It is strictly less than infinity. But this is rigorously true.
Yeah.
Okay, what it says though, however, that it doesn't prove that the kappas themselves cannot be singular. It just says that time averages are bounded. But so this is a weak solution result, and out of the way. Okay, now for R is 1, I think we did this something like a few years ago. For R is 2, for R is greater than 1, basically Charlie and I did this here about 2 weeks ago. Okay.
This is very important, and this tells you that as long as you're interested in statistical averages, in terms of which we consider averages, then those similarities don't matter for whatever large n, for whatever high derivatives you go.
For kappa to the 1, but if you want kappa squared, if you want mass of the energy
exactly.
Spectrum. Then there would be kappa squared.
If you wanted regularity, you would need something like kappa squared or kappa cubed inside, and we don't have it. That's where we lose.
Just moments of the...
Yeah. So we need we need averages of higher powers of kappa to actually get regularity. But nevertheless, I would...
Kappa is positive, I mean, it's indefinite.
Yes. Yeah, it's this thing. Yeah, it's notions of derivatives. Now, as I finish, I would like to point out that you could argue that the kappa being a wave number out to the minus one, but you could argue that you could identify it with little out to the minus one of some small length scale in the system. Okay, it's the length scale. Okay, the problem is the bounds are so huge and all we have is this time average. But this is true, and it's true for all r greater than 1, for n greater than r.
As you just might mention, that kappa 1-0 is the Taylor microscale, the inverse Taylor microscale.
Yeah. Yeah.
So these are all things that are generalizations of these small scales that you could define.
Wait, you tell me, where are normal scales here? Because,
He's hit on it. This is exactly what we've been discussing.
We'll hand you the paper.
This is a very good point. That is an extremely good point. But observe the following. Take r to be 0. What is hn, which is 2 to root, which is like the square of n derivatives over h naught, go into Fourier space, and kappa n naught is exactly moments of the energy spectrum.
So it's not moments of velocity differences.
Mm-hmm.
But take E of k, uh-huh, and look at k to the n, k to the 2n, k to the 4n.
Uh-huh.
It's, so it's moments of the energy spectrum.
It's moments of the kappa, are really moments of the energy spectrum.
And
the
you've hit
exactly on the point that when you go through all these inequalities, they all scale properly with dimension. And then you fail, as I've described here, basically you fail to do the thing, you fail to get regularity. To get regularity, you would need some anomalous scaling. You would need exactly some anomalous scaling in these kappas in order to get regularity. But we actually have a suspicion, and we wrote a fairly loose-ish paper on this, exactly what the anomalous scaling you would need in the kappas in order to, for the fluid to be regular.
Not just any anomalous scaling, it might be bound on it.
Yes.
Because, I mean, this
is what it's an unintuitive result. If the scaling is anomalous enough, then it bites its own tail off and becomes regular.
Yeah.
And we give the exact boundary of how what we mean by
it. So you know the second moment is better than Kolmogorov would get any
now. Yeah, yeah.
But it's the other way around. If it's worse, then it's actually better. In other words, if it's more violent, well, not for two, but for the higher ones.
We'll show you the paper. I think I've essentially said what I wanted to say.
Okay.
So people want to ask me questions.
A lot worse. The
question I had was related to the point you made earlier, yeah, and also which is a lot of people know, this blue dot curve.
Yeah.
Namely, that at high Reynolds number, or as high as you can compute, the points of very high vorticity generation, stretching, or very high velocity, are associated with dipole structures.
Okay.
And these are a very, very small part of the volume that you make. You say, well, the high regions of vorticity are a very small part of the volume. And yet those are the points that we're trying to get at by these moments.
Oh, what's
that? That was a horrible way to go about it, but that's all we have.
Yeah.
So the question is, could it be that if you focused on sort of bipolar structures, in other words, you say, I'm going to look only at those regions and forget about all the vorticity, because it's just not important. Couldn't you possibly, drawing a problem out, saying, I'm going to restrict the solution to this class of solutions, that's it, make better estimates? In other words, your estimates would immediately have to be sharper.
Yeah. That's the game, that kind of game. No one has yet been able to make it work.
But a lot of people say this, for example, a lot of people do calculations like Chief Chen. They don't ask that question. They calculate a lot of moments of structure functions and stuff like that, and just by the talk today, that's not the right question to be asking in your data.
Some conditional thing you want.
Yes.
Well,
yeah.
But we have thought of this idea, though. The problem is that we've never been able to knock it into enough shape to get to even get the formalism right to do what you're asking. But I agree, that's what we'll have to do.
And you pointed out, and that's very true, we all noticed that.
The local topology of the vorticity field is clearly what one needs to get at. This sort of global averaging in L2 is not the right thing to do. But how one gets real topology into the vorticity field of Navier-Stokes is a different... without making gross assumptions that are even worse than assumptions like this, you see. But that's the problem of how we get real geometry and do analysis on it.
Local stuff, but of course, it's very non-local problem.
You know, Sergei Kovsin, so he was working on measures of singularity, so yeah. He was addressing this question.
Yeah.
So trying to single out three hypotheses and characterize them using some fractional dimension, product dimension.
Right, well,
did you do anything on the
those are the theorems.
No, Kovsin is doing
theorems.
So, but he didn't do it for Euler, he did it for non-linear.
But was the famous result by Caparelli, Cohn, and Nuremberg?
Right.
And that
is, it's a fractal dimension. Well, it says the dimension of any singularity in space-time is less than or equal to 1.
Yeah.
So that means if you take a time slice, they have to occur only at points.
Or less than a line. Less than a line.
Yeah.
So in other words, you can't have volumes blowing up.
Right.
If the singularity occurs, it must go out on a line or at a point.
And this
can
be anomalous
scaling
immediately.
Yes, I think that's right. But that Caparelli-Cohn-Nuremberg paper came out in about late 80s, early 90s. I think it's 10 years old, roughly. It's very clever, extremely technical paper, as you can imagine from the reputation of the authors.
Unless there are serious comments that need to be made now, I suggest we get our lunch
and
re-adjourn at 5:30 for the next deliberations. Thank you, John.
Yes, sure.
Let's be mindful
of what
Because, you know, interestingly, I bumped it with the indulging special laws using the hyperparameter formulation for this.